Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Robert Cook. Robert is the Senior Vice President of Global Markets at Hyphen Foods, a leading provider of 100% vegetarian frozen snacks made from the finest vegetables. With over 15 years of experience in global markets, Robert has a proven track record in business strategy, sales, and change management. I've asked Robert to join us here today to share his story and discuss expanding global reach and delivering exceptional products to consumers worldwide. Robert, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me.
Perfect. All right. So we're back. So good. Yes. So thank you for joining us here. Now, before we get into talking about what you do now and how you got to here, how did you even get started in business? Do you come from a family of entrepreneurs? Are you following in your parents' footsteps?
Oh, I suppose you could say my father was, he was a sole business owner, sole proprietor. He owned his own little manufacturing business back in South Africa, manufacturing wardrobes, cupboards, and other furniture for the small domestic market. Nothing on any large scale, but definitely an owner's mindset. But yeah, both my siblings weren't entrepreneurs. They went into various fields, into education, and the other into accountancy. Different paths, but yeah, you'd probably say I got it from my father, actually.
Were you helping out in the family business as a kid? Is that
No, just the passion has really just come from as I got older. I think as I entered the workforce, I just started to listen, learn, and watch others, and just started to pick up any niches and I guess a path for my own where I wanted to dive into.
so then how did you get into marketing and sales and obviously international? That sounds like you're with your dad. A lot of people, they don't necessarily even leave their hometown, so to speak. So what happened next?
So I actually started off in auditing. Funny enough, I worked for one of the big four back in South Africa, is where I grew up. My family, both my siblings and my parents, immigrated to Australia and New Zealand. And I stayed in South Africa to get work experience for myself. I wanted to develop my own path and go wherever the world takes me, but I wanted to do it on my own accord. But yeah, strange. Ended up in auditing. I went into the consulting and advisory side of one of the big accounting firms. I worked both in public and private sector, but then ventured and dabbled a bit in forensic auditing, funny enough. So I had a passion for the detail, but it only really started really getting commercially, I suppose the attraction to be really commercial, and that started happening where I was able to get venture more into business development. And you could say product or service, depending on the industry, at the end of the day, you're selling something, and how you pitch and engage with customers is all very much on the same process that you can apply. So people always talk about if you've got nothing tangible. I always say it's actually quite hard when you don't have something tangible and you're offering a service. How do you deliver that value or demand that value to the customer you're selling it to? So I think that was always something I found that you had to think a little bit outside the box. And so the consultancy side of the practice, I actually engaged more in trying to do more business development. And I suppose that led me to looking abroad. Eventually moved to New Zealand, not because my folks were there, but just I got a job offer to start up a revenue line. It will be a part of a new revenue line within the consulting practice at KPMG in New Zealand. And again, I was given it was starting up, I was able to apply a lot more practice into business development, meeting new customers, understanding a new culture, which I think added to my arsenal, and it gave me a bit of more broader view on the world. You grow up, and I suppose to your point, the world is so much bigger than the small town and the community you're so comfortable in living in for most of your life. So going out there and taking that risk it's a massive risk. But from a development perspective, personally, and culturally, it's massive. So I think you gain significantly by just trying to live in someone else's country, learn a little bit more about that culture, but how you manage those different cultures and diversity within that market is significant develop personally.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. I never really realized. I remember when I went to Japan, And I was so naive. People were asking me about culture shock. And I thought, culture shock, smulture shock. We all have moms and hearts and hair and skins, team humanity type thing. And how little did I know that there are very real cultural differences. And it doesn't make
Huge.
us, yeah, it doesn't make us incompatible. It's just, it really helps you appreciate the rainbow, so to speak, of diversity out there, to use a couple of maybe buzzwords. But can you maybe talk to some of the fundamentals? So what are the basics of biz development? What is that? It's a word thrown around a lot, but what are the fundamentals of business development? How does somebody even know how to approach it?
You got to know what you're selling, first of all, right? So you've got to have a. I always find there's when there's a purpose behind something you're selling, there's a belief when you're telling the story and trying to sell it. So a purpose behind what you're selling, and apart from understanding what you're selling, are fundamentals. Then it's never easy for some introverts to get engaged in it, but you'll be surprised. I think when you apply a process to it, and you understand the product and you believe it, you'll be surprised how easy you can sell it. So I think that's one thing. And then obviously, continuous engagement with customers. You've got to know your audience. You've got to know the category and the industry you're playing in. So a lot of research is needed. And I think a lot of the hard work is done before you even enter the meeting for any customer or client that you're trying to engage with. Once you're there, it's a part of listening more than speaking. You can start with really good opening questions and engaging questions, but you've got to be able to listen to be able to pick up certain reads on your customer, because you can't go in with a direct narrative. I always find that once you can have a very clear narrative that you want to get the sale at the end of the day, but you also got to be open that you're not going to get the sale on the first meeting. I think the most important thing is listening, taking some cues from the customer as well, understanding their needs. You might have to look down a different rabbit hole or go down a different path in order to really gain their trust and then really build that relationship before you engage. So every customer is different, and that's why I think it's important. You've got to have an open mind when you go into these business development meetings.
I love that. I think that's a great recap. I wrote down, what do you know what you're really selling? Know what the story is, the purpose, apply a process to it. Continuous engagement with customers, lots of research is needed. Once there, listen more than you talk. Cannot be direct, be open to meet them where they are, gain their trust, build a relationship. Is that a fair summary of
Yeah.
what you said? Did I miss anything?
No, I think that's right, because you're not there for one sale. So if you end with trust and you've built, that's where retention comes in.
Yeah, I heard this somewhere. I don't know who said it first, but they said if a sale is a golden egg, the customer is the goose who lays them. And so many people think the egg itself is the purpose. The goal is to get the sale, but it's not. The goal is to get a sale so you can get a customer, not to get. And that's, I think, a great way to look at it. It's not about the sale, is just the beginning. And a lot of people, they think when they get a sale from someone, they like, oh, that's my customer. But if you had a boyfriend or a girlfriend and you didn't go on a date with them for 2 years, you didn't see them for 2 years, are they still your boyfriend or girlfriend? So just because someone comes and does business with you once doesn't mean that there's an ongoing relationship there. And I think it speaks to the concept of playing long-term games with long-term people, what you're talking about, that you might get a sale, but really what you're in there for is to build trust in a relationship, to have an ongoing business relationship, a long-term thing. Otherwise, it's just really short-sighted. Could you maybe speak to understanding a new culture and doing business in a new culture? Because obviously you've done this a couple of times,
Yeah.
and we talked about cultural lenses, and I speak four languages now, I think, English, French, Japanese. I'm low intermediate in Tagalog now. The other ones I'm pretty good at. But I know when I learn a language, I always feel it's like a different personality or code to communicate in, and that our cultural lenses, they're almost like sunglasses. If you have blue sunglasses and ever the world looks blue or pink, that with cultures, there's literally a cultural lens people see the world through. So could you maybe talk to understanding a new culture and how do you engage with and do business and learn? Is it just trial and error and you're just a bull in a china shop to begin with? or is there some nuanced? What have you learned?
Yeah, and it's very difficult. So I think when I first immigrated to New Zealand and started working in that environment, I think there's a lot of things that you can find that are similar. So I always try to find very quickly when you're in a different culture, what are the things you can relate? It always helps break down barriers so you can open up general conversation. So when you can relate for certain things, that's a little bit easier. But again, there's so many differences. And I think if I refer just even if you look on the western side of the world, and I refer to South Africa as being Western, just in terms of, I guess, culturally where they are and their infrastructure. But I think when I moved to New Zealand, South Africans are very direct. And so we get to the point. It's not that we're trying to be insult or trying to enforce anything. It's just we hear, we listen, and we can answer directly. We don't work around certain questions or answers. That is not acceptable in New Zealand. They're a bit more laid back, and it's like you'll get things done, and there might be a slightly slower pace. So you're going to have to adapt in terms of deadlines, and there's not much of a doggy dog type of culture there, which I was used to growing up. So it helped me break down a lot of walls and be a bit more patient. In my understanding, which I think really helped my management style as I moved up in the organization. And then I was very fortunate to travel with the company I was working for in New Zealand, which was Fonterra. I moved to Malaysia, slightly different. But if you look at the work in place, it's a lot of it is Malay Chinese, and they actually prefer direct discussions and direction on certain things. So you find a balance between the two. Yeah. And then you come to the Philippines, where I think there's a lot of energy. Filipinos are the most fantastic people in the world. They're loving culture. They're so abrasive. They love life. They've always got a smile on their face. But you cannot ever be direct in the Philippines. You have to have some sort of trust and almost a loving kindness when dealing with them. So how you discuss and manage certain things is probably worldly different to how you manage it in other areas. And I think that's why we love Southeast Asia so much. It's so diverse that every country is different. Although it's one region, it's so different in the different cultures and I suppose how you manage those cultures. So I think that was a very rude awakening, but patience, 100%. You've got to be able to relate to that culture in some way, be it sport, be it in government or issues or whatever it may be. You need to find something that you can relate to, start that break down those barriers, and then you can obviously push through and try to learn a little bit more.
I think that's really important and really powerful. And I think just if people just recognize that exists, there's really simple things too. I remember my daughter, she goes to this private school, and I was talking to one of the fathers, and he's an American, spent 10 years, something like that, doing business out of Singapore. And I asked him about cultural differences. And he said, a lot of the stuff you can figure out, but one of the things a lot of my coworkers wouldn't get when they came over is that he said the Singaporean culture, if you're too dressed up, maybe you're a little too uptight. And if you're too business casual or too casual. So he's just like khakis and a collared shirt is fine, but it has to be a brand name. If it's not a brand name shirt, you'll be in the meeting and it'll be smiles and nods and handshakes all around, but they'll never do business with you and you won't know
They
why.
won't take you seriously.
And I thought that was so interesting, like just such a nuanced little thing. And maybe there's 101 things, maybe some matter, maybe some don't. People could argue if the offer was good enough, things like that wouldn't matter. It doesn't hurt to learn the intricacies of that and understand. And I think you talk about the Philippines. I think in the Philippines is one of those countries where personal introductions are incredibly powerful in this kind of country like this. To meet someone cold versus a warm introduction. And a lot of the stuff I feel, and this is me, I think you may have more experience than I do, but I feel like the book How to Win Friends and Influence People is just a great book for anyone in any culture to read. It'll help you go leaps and bounds further as you learn some of those cultural nuances. That would be a tip that I would have if anyone felt that they were either starting out or struggling. What would you recommend to someone who is starting out or struggling? They're in a new country, they're in business dev, or they're just trying to figure out their way. We've already given some good tips. They may want to re-listen to make sure they got them all, but to really hit the nail on the head, any specific advice if someone's starting or struggling?
Yeah. So you go when you, if you're moving as an expat with a company, make sure you always ask for cultural training when you enter that market. Most of them offer it, it's there. So make sure you utilize that. I think that's very important. Gives you a head start into some of the key things that you need to know, be it religion, some of the subtle ways and ways to not greet within the country. I think those are always things. I think it's always important to also learn very basic keywords, be it please, thank you, in those words. Those go a long way in meetings, or whether you even say hello and goodbye. If you could master five key words that you could either open or close a discussion, I think is super vital and is extremely appreciated by the people you're dealing with in the market. If you don't have, obviously, if you're moving over and you've got your own business and you can't afford to do any cultural training, then absolutely, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Read those books, as many books as possible, to get as much background as possible when entering the market. Again, those books are taken from a perspective, and as well, the cultural training is taken from a perspective and generalized. So you're going to have to still have an open mind dealing with people and different personalities in each market as well.
That's really well said. What are some specific skills or behaviors that you think are important for staff or maybe even for yourself to improve and develop as you think about things moving forward? Obviously, we talked about the fundamentals, we've talked about understanding the new new culture, but generally speaking, what are some of the skills and behaviors that you think are important to constantly refine and develop?
Professionally speaking, I would probably say from as you get into management, I think it's important to be very clear on your expectations in your market. A lot of things may be misinterpreted slightly different, be if there's slight language barriers, or you might have said something in a different tone that might be misinterpreted something as opposed to just the words in itself. It's always important when you set those expectations to reiterate it and then to still ask the question whether it is understood. Yes, it's time consuming. Yes, it might be a little bit overboard, but I can tell you what, it definitely beats relitigation when you're doing work and trying to deliver on something. These are subtle things you obviously learn when you go by market, and I wish someone told me that. Tell them again and then retell them, I think, is the most important thing. And it's not that you're trying to insult. I think it's just important, given the cultural and language barriers that they're there, that you just need to make sure everything is clear, because a lot of the time you just don't have or can afford that relitigation in coming back to the same point or addressing the same problem, or and you've got timelines and deliverables and getting that done. So yeah, expectation and clarity on what is needed and where you're headed is very important. I think even when you're dealing with different cultures, they still want to know where they're going and what, and most importantly, what do they contribute into supporting getting there. Because a lot of the people, they just end the business and they get down to it. But I love to always walk around and ask the question. And yes, it can be confronting at times, but it's, do you know how you contribute to the organization? Because everyone is there, but a lot of them just continue with their head down and BAU because they're in a process. But there's a purpose for why they're there and what they're contributing for the organization. Once you can help them understand that as well, the value that they feel and the importance, and more about the ownership in wanting to deliver, is crucial. And they actually have a bit more purpose within the organization itself.
Yeah, I love that. And you made me think about when I was working in Japan. I worked 3 years in Tokyo. And when I got back, when I was finally moving back to Canada, I remember thinking, oh, thank goodness I'm going to go back to Canada. Everybody speaks English in Canada. I'm not going to have any of these communication issues that I had in Japan. Everyone's just going to understand me. And then I got back And I thought, what is happening here? And it made me laugh because before, like I said, we're all humans, right? Culture change. But at this end of the day, I was still having those communication challenges. So I think they're more emphasized when there's a language barrier and that, but that they really do exist. And it's, I think that's great advice. What are some of the trends that you're watching and paying attention to? We've had seen a lot happen, obviously, in the last few years. We're in a post-COVID world right now. There's a lot shaking up politically, geopolitically, economically. What are some of the emerging trends and developments that you're watching and paying attention to on over the next 5, 10 year horizon?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing now at the moment in particular is the output of the difficult macro challenges that we've seen over the last few years. It started with COVID, but then we've had the wars both in Russia, Ukraine, and then obviously Israel and Gaza. I think that has provided a lot of instability economically. The output of that, and it's the same old story, the middle class and the lower middle class are the ones that are significantly impacted. I'd probably say even more so this time that the middle class is getting the most impacted, because I always find that the lower class is that they've always known how to deal, and they've got the resilience to, all right, this is happening again, we'll go back to our normal staples and necessities. But it's very hard when you have a growing middle class and you're starting to appreciate certain luxuries, and there's an expectation on families to live a certain life, and then to dial back that, which is quite considerable with the in today's means, is it's becoming very difficult to deal with. And you're not surprised people having to make some huge decisions financially on what how they're going to live their life moving forward, especially in the medium term. I wouldn't even say short term. I think we've still got a good 12 plus months to deal with this. Consumers in the market are really struggling, and they are definitely having to make certain choices to ensure that they've got the right amount of income on a monthly basis. Out-of-pocket spend has reduced that across all categories in retail. If you look at some of the retail segment, and I'm speaking purely around food products and food in general because it's my area of expertise, but I think all categories are declining, and those who are somewhat benefiting somewhat is the mass categories. And I say mass categories because they are price attractive, and so a lot of people are trading down. If I used to get an A-class product, I'm trading down to B or even to a C in order to reduce my out-of-pocket spend for the month. And so you're seeing that across the board. So most of your premium, super premium products are in heavy decline. And so when you're in that position, inflation increases in order to make up revenue, companies are starting to even increase price. So the base consumers that are still within that category, although volume's down, a lot of the companies having to increase price in those categories, but it's not offsetting the deficit on the on volume that they've lost as a result of consumers trading down. Now, that's in retail. If you look at food service, it's somewhat funny because, yes, there was a significantly or a significant decrease when you went into COVID. And when I look at food service, I think about hospitality, I think of restaurants, cafes. But we saw post-COVID, there was some revenge spending in that category. People missed it and they wanted to keep doing that. With prices increasing, there seems to be a lot more stability, and people are willing, instead of they're making choices, but they're still going on holiday and they're still eating out at their cafe. And some cafes and restaurants, especially quick service restaurants like your takeaway restaurants, are actually sometimes more affordable than purchasing from retail, especially when you've got a bar for bigger families. Yeah, consumers are making choices financially. It's not great for the market. And yes, it's I don't think salaries have gone up or even met inflation that has been rising over the last 2 to 3 years. So until that salary cycle kind of rejuvenates and makes up for the inflation, because they're all families are at a deficit at the moment because inflation's rising, as opposed to not all companies increasing their merits in line with inflation. Some of them can't, some of them don't. And sometimes the inflation's a little bit too high. So that's where the challenging part in the market is at the moment. And yeah, consumers, especially in the middle class, I would say, is significantly battling.
So what I'm hearing is that people are being squeezed a little bit because, one, the salaries are relatively static, but inflation is eating the purchasing power, but also companies, some companies have had to increase prices to try to make up for the lost volume. And that creates a multi-pressure point scenario where people are being squeezed in multiple areas. And so customers are really looking for the most excellent product, not necessarily just on price alone, but they're really looking for, I'd say value, but I don't necessarily want to say value in terms of I get a giant bulk of garbage. I still want to eat healthy versus just eat crackers all day.
Yeah, actually value is not a bad term. You probably say value for money in terms of purchase, which is definitely something we use. They are looking for deals, bundles, options where they could save. But they are trading down on nutrition as well, because obviously some of the higher or the super premium products have got higher nutrition value. So instead of they go for their base needs. So if you say, for example, for dairy, if I was getting nutrition powder with a lot of fortified ingredients in it that have added an extra protein, extra calcium, extra this and that, that add to my benefit, now trading down to just regular milk to get the basic needs on calcium that I might need, or milk powder, if we speak in particular for this market. So yes, they are trading down, but they're trading down to a basic need as to trying to increase their nutritional value.
Yeah, I was going to say, because when you start talking about the milk with all those things, it's funny, I'm going through this nutrition course. I'm one of those health nuts. I read research papers on longevity and all-cause mortality like candy and for fun. I'm weird like that. And so like Brian Johnson is a guy that made 100 million and then spent 2 million trying to figure out how to slow and reverse aging. And he released something called the Blueprint. And I looked at it and I was, I'm already doing 80% of this, 90% of this. I just can't afford to have all my organs tested every week like he does.
Yeah.
So I felt good about that. And I'm listening to this nutrition course. And I hope I'm being tactful in saying this, but I guess you're South African. So in the nutrition course, I feel like the instructor is doing all these backward somersaults. And I've even commented multiple times on this. I feel like he's doing all this work just the major ultra high processed food companies can still have a seat at the table, because he's just dancing around everything. Like the fact that most high ultra processed foods are mostly carbs and fats and they're empty calories. And I just feel what you talked about there, like you give me milk, but then you've added to that. I don't know if that makes it a better quality product, if I'm being really honest. I think that sometimes the less is better. And I remember I was so impressed. You talked about the company you're working with now, their story about how they have a technology and they sprout their vegetable or the potato up in the Himalayan mountains because at the altitude, it's a sterile environment. So they don't have to worry about bugs and bacteria and stuff. I just love that so much, because what I felt like what it delivered was just pure mother of the earth goodness, so to speak. And so you talk about that trading. I wonder how much of that is also a reevaluation of, I don't have an answer, but I wonder how much of this swapping options is a reevaluation of value in the eyes of the customer. Because when you'd said that to me, I thought, I actually want the raw milk. That's what I want. I get raw buffalo milk where I can here in the Philippines. Like I just give me the tit. I just want it. I'll just suck it right out of the beast myself.
Yeah, but I think there's two different markets, right? You're saying is probably right. There's that, but I guess where you're purchasing from versus where the demographic is purchasing at maybe 10 pesos a milk powder sachet, which has still been heavily processed in order to get it to that thing, is very different to the, let's call it raw or simple ingredients that is produced at a lower scale. And so in order to make those specialized foods, it's actually at a higher cost because of the lower output. When you got these big companies and these mass things that are generally put into retail, they're produced at such a significant large scale that it's making peanuts, and so they can deliver at a price that is attractive to your consumer. So whether it's, you know, I'm not saying dairy is not healthy, but I think if you look at significantly processed goods and You look at the market chain, you go look at some cheese in the market. Some of it just sits on the shelf, not even in the chiller. And so you have to then look at how much cheese is actually in there. And it's actually, there's a lot of the cheese that has been substituted for vegetable fat. And so these cheese
Or
shouldn't
seed
just be able
oils.
to, yeah. And so then you've got to ask yourself whether the nutritional value is not. But again, it comes out, it's now because they've taken all the fat and the protein and the goodness out of the product and substituted with all that, but still be able to make claims on that product, they could sell it at a significantly reduced price. And I'll open up a can in terms of where we go in this discussion, but then you've got to say, what is FDA's responsibility in making sure that these suppliers or these manufacturers are responsible in selling certain products, but they make it at a bare minimum. And then these you look at then what you can claim with what you're selling and then market it as such. So yeah, it's very different. It's very
It's a big
different.
can of worms, and I'm a completely different person today than I was pre-COVID in terms of trust in that. It's actually recently just come out that the FDA is in the middle of a bunch of lawsuits because they're not in the business of doing medicine. They're in the business of doing prescriptions. So their whole that tweet, "Y'all not a horse, stop it," that they're being held accountable to the tune of millions of lives that could have been saved. That's a new within the last 24-hour breaking news thing on that. We'll see where all that goes, but it's definitely an interesting rabbit hole. One thing that really shocked me talking about living in Japan is I grew up as a kid in Canada, and you get the fruit juice. Oh, I'm gonna get this apple drink. And in
Precious
Japan,
produce.
it's mandated they have to put what percentage is real fruit juice on the bottle. And I was so shocked because I saw brands that I thought were obviously, this is obviously orange juice. And it was all 100%, 98%, 2%, or 1%. That was it. There was no 37% juice, 30. It was 100% juice. It was 98, 97%, or it was 1, 2%. That was it. And I was so shocked. I'd seen some of these bottles in Canada. And I'm like, how is it legal for them to even market this as whatever juice when there's 1%? It's almost factually, there's probably more urine in this thing than there is fruit juice. So that's an interesting can of worms there. But to reel us back in, what are some of the habits that you feel were most important for you, helping you on your path to success, whether they're daily or weekly? What are some of the habits that you think really contributed to you being able to perform, both in terms of climbing the ladder, but also in terms of performing at your work?
So I always very clearly know who my stakeholders are. And I think that's very important because if you know who they are and what is expected of you with those stakeholders and you ensure that you deliver, then you are seen in a very good light and you're seen as making progress or adding value. All right. Doesn't necessarily mean that you don't do anything else, but I think it's important that that is when you're working in a hierarchical multinational corporation, right? It's playing the game. But essentially, the most important thing is learning how to prioritize. And I learned this the hard way. You can't do everything, even though you have to. But I always use the rule, and I'm sure you've seen it on YouTube around big rocks first, where they got a study and the guy's using golf balls and he keeps asking the class, is the cup full? And they keep saying yes, but then he adds sand and water and pebbles and whatever, and then it's only full. And the reason on that concept is that know what your big rocks are. Now, it might be personal, might be professional, whatever it is, and you can structure it how you want, but always deliver on your big rocks first. If you deliver on those, that means the bulk of, and those are the big stressful buckets, the most important things in your life, if you, and professionally and personally. If you can deliver on those, then you've probably met 80% expectation. Then all the things that follow that, you can follow based on prioritization. So if you deliver on those, you'll be surprised how you can get the rest of that done. But if you're focusing and worrying about the little bits and pieces to which they're not significant enough, but they're taking up time, they're causing stress, then they're going to disrupt on you delivering on the most important things that mean more to not only yourself, but to the people that are relying on you. So I think that's a very clear perspective and something I always talk to with my staff is always manage and deliver on your big rocks first. The rest always follows.
I love that. I think that's really powerful, really important. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you think you see people making?
I
That question
think,
upside down.
yeah, I think it's exactly that. So in reverse, people get stuck on those nitty-gritty, perhaps less important stuff, and they forget about delivering on the big rocks. So again, I'll revert back to what we've just discussed, is that focus on your big rocks and then know who your stakeholders are and make sure you deliver on those first before you focus on other stuff.
I love that. Robert, this has been a great interview. I've got a couple of pages of notes here. Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
No, I suppose more just around where I am at the moment. So, interesting point in my life is where I've worked for multinationals for my whole career, close to 20 years, and then came to a point in my life as where to next. Do I stay with the current organization? Which means relocating back home, which home is New Zealand for me. Do I go to other multinationals? And I was at a point where I had the opportunity where my international assignment was ending and to really take a view as to what I want moving forward. A lot of the time when you move back, you become a lifer and a few doors shut. You've developed so much and invested so much. I like to refer to it as professional equity in these markets that you're in and developed such broad and high networks that you've got to look at what else is out there before you make the decision. And I'm purely probably talking from an expat perspective, but I think it's an important decision point when you reach. So I think for me personally, I was very lucky to have a few options on the table and one with a private company, smaller scale than what I'm used to, but fast growing with exceptional growth potential. And I suppose to your point, what the purpose and the story behind it is what gravitated me towards this opportunity. And I thought it allowed me to do that, plus continue to do my own personal business and ventures on the side that I've now been able to start. I think it's given me a different view on life, on what I want to do in the next 10, 20 years. And yeah, I think everyone to themselves. But when you get in the position, I think it's really take a hard look and reflect on where you are before just following the company back to either another country or to back to a headquarters, back to the host or home country, because there's a lot of opportunity when you've developed and you've lived in these markets for such a long time that you actually, if you take a step back, you've developed such a lot of professional equity that you can earn from. And there's a lot of doors open. So I think that's something I would say probably to reflect on. It was an eye-opener for me as well.
Yeah, I think so too. It's easy to get stuck. I forget. I wish I had it, but it was something like when you're too comfortable, that's when frustration and regret and anxiety and depression creep in, that we're meant here to grow. It's funny, if you look at any plant in the wilderness, it's always going to grow to its maximum potential. Any
Yeah.
animal in the animal kingdom is going to do the best it can to reach its full potential. There's only humans that sometimes settle for less. And I think that's a really important message to keep growing, to keep pushing, to keep taking on new challenges. Like I said, I already said it, I was so enamored by the story of the company. Maybe do you want to share a little bit about your company story right now?
Yeah, look, it's a company out of India. We export frozen, potato-based variety of goods, but to yourself, it's India is probably where China was 15 years ago. There's always this trust around quality and how you develop in the markets. But if you look at now, the output and the quality of the products being produced in India is quite exceptional. So after doing a bit of research and then visiting the plant and looking at the technology that has been invested in, which is of high tech, and the story with this particular company I'm with, Hyphen Foods, it's remarkable. And to your point, they want to own the quality through the end-to-end process. If you look at most, it's French fry companies or potato frozen goods companies, they refer to a model called farm to fork. from farm to obviously the table to which you eat. They've taken it a few steps back and gone seed to shelf. And the reason why we use that model is because we actually grow the seeds in market. We do it in labs, hydroponics and aeroponics. And then we take it, once the seeds are at a point where it's ready to start growing, we take it up to the Himalayas. And to reiterate what you said, is the reason why we do that there is to free it from all bacteria and disease, because it's at the altitude point where those certain things just don't exist. And once it gets to, say, a small sized potato, we then bring it, and I always like using this term, is bring it back down to earth. And we sell these at a very competitive price to farmers, and which we then buy it back from the farmers at a higher than market rate price, which, again, to the sustainability side of it, is not just on the product, it's also about the producing of it. And that you're going to get more farmers because you're paying them a good price. We also train them on certain farming practices as well. And this is all before it gets into production on the quality, because you have to manage the quality of the input before you put it through a production of which your output is quality. The old thing with even data, rubbish in, rubbish out. So you've got to make sure you own that. Whereas a lot of people, they just get it from farm to fork. That means they open themselves up to procuring from all different farmers, and you might be able to, you don't have a stronghold on the quality of the potato. We select the farmers who purchase our potatoes. We then buy it back. But to that point, we've owned and monitored the menu, or should we say, the development of that potato
Product.
right up to the point before it even goes into manufacturing. And then obviously you've got these significantly high-tech plants which produce a really great finished good. It's a lovely story, and it's just, the president in India is just, he's going gangbusters around, we want to export. And I think I referred to you in our earlier discussions is that while the rest of the world's been in conflict, India's just been doing business. They've been shaking hands, opening markets. And now you look at, you've got all this, the largest consumer country in the world is now got free trade with all these markets and is incentivizing export as well. So if you export, you get a percentage
I love
in
that.
return.
I love
So I
that.
think it's how it's been great. I think it's a great learning curve, and kudos to India. I think they're headed in the right direction.
Yeah, 100%. I think if your biggest issue in your life is pronouns, you really are missing out on life. I got no issues. I got no issues. I got no qualms, but I just think there's a saying. I don't know who said it, but it's you can't keep wealth past three generations. The first one struggles to earn it. The second one witnessed their parents grind, respects it, preserves it. And the third one is so far removed from the principles that got them to where they are, they squander it. And I just feel that's where we're at right now, where you've got DEI hiring quotas and safe space pronoun. People don't understand. It's going to be a rude wake-up call. And I'm just grateful that I had this epiphany. It felt like an epiphany to me earlier in the year. Where it's not that necessarily good defeats evil. I think a lot of the things that people attribute to goodness are just behaviors and philosophies that perpetuate themselves. So it's not that good beats evil, it's that it outgrows it, and that stagnation and decay is not a pleasant thing. So if you have behaviors, if you carry philosophies that are stagnant or self-defeating, that's like the evil, so to speak. And I don't mean to pick on any group, but a really easy example. Again, I don't personally, but religions typically don't like homosexuality. And I think if you think about it on a long-term, multi-generational scale, well, that's a philosophy that's not going to really carry itself forward. There's no offspring. And so that's a crude, easy way to delineate. And again, I'm not trying to pass judgment on anyone, but just that there's principles of growth and prosperity and long, multi-generational longevity. And that what we see coming from India, I mean, that between India and China, that's half the world population. I think China's got a lot of troubles. I know it sounds like India, obviously India's got their own struggles, but there just seems to be a lot of good things coming out of India right now. And I think it's,
Yeah, a lot of growth, a lot of promise, and they're delivering on it, which is great to see.
If people want to follow up, if they want to connect, if they want to reach out, what are some of the best ways for them to get in touch?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. They can reach out to me on LinkedIn. That's probably the
Perfect.
best possible route. Not too big on other social medias, but yeah, absolutely. I'm on LinkedIn there should they want to connect.
So look him up, Robert Cook, Robert Cook, Cook. You know it's him if it's Hyphen Foods, HYFUNFODS. That is HYFUNFODS. So you know you've got the right Robert Cook. Robert, thank you for joining us today. It's been an honor and a pleasure knowing that you've got your own direct reports, your own priorities. Thank you for coming and sharing with my audience and I so we can all do a little bit better.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.